What?
Session of Song of Songs. I can't believe it. It's only 8 chapters, yeah. So last time we ended up at chapter 7, verse 10, where she, the Shulamite, the believer, the church, says, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. So this is kind of now we're at the culmination of the chapter. She's matured. She's gone through some trials. Now she understands that she belongs to him. He's done everything to get her on board. He sees her as the final. He sees us and her as we are in our completed state, not in our current mess that we're in. And now she's finally come to realize, so now she's totally devoted to him. She says, I'm his. And when the other people there were saying, you know, what's so great about your beloved? Meaning they had other beloveds too, like we all do. We all have other beloveds. So she rattles off a whole list of things about how awesome he is. And then the other people say, wow, we want to know him too. So she becomes an evangelist now, as well as, you know, the other things that she's been talking about. So now she's starting to do something. She hasn't done anything up to this point. But she's the fairest one. She's got dove's eyes. He's totally, you know, how many times, 18 times or whatever it is, and he tells her that she's beautiful and she's the fairest one. And so now she's got to the point where she's ready to serve. She's ready to work. And this confession that I'm his and he's mine in 7:10 is kind of like the culmination of the thing. So when you encounter Jesus in a way that you finally surrender to him and realize what he is, then your whole life, not only does your whole life change and you get transformed, but then you realize this has been the whole purpose of your life all along. So that all the other stuff kind of fades out, including medicine and including everything. But who cares? But pretty soon it's all going to be gone. This is going to be awesome. I hope it's tonight, like I always say. But anyway, so now she's culminating now. She's totally involved now in ministry. She's been commissioned. She's been prepared. You know, she's filled with the Spirit. So now she completely belongs to him. And, you know, this is how, you know, Paul talks in Romans 5. We did Romans here. You know, the Spirit dwells in us. You know, and then in 8 he talks about how the Spirit comes into our spirit and tells us we're adopted sons. We're co-heirs with Christ. And so this is the whole point of the imagery of the church is the bride of Christ. He's the groom. The church is the bride. You know, the Father has a bride for his Son. The Son presents the bride to the Father. The Holy Spirit, you know, goes through and empowers people and, you know, does the work within the body. So all these things are working together. So that in Ephesians 5, it says we're presented as the church is presented as a pure and spotless bride. Which is pretty cool. Because none of us are pure and none of us are spotless. I'm a mess. Anyway, I'm a mess. But I'm a mess. And, you know, so now we see what happens when she gets empowered for ministry. Now she's in the next phase. And keep in mind, the church now is in a really getting excited and revved up for the new evangelization. You know, you can't assume that the people sitting next to you in the pew know the gospel. You can't assume that the people sitting behind you are tuned in to the Lord. You can't assume that. So now, let's read 7:11 and 12. 11 and 12.
Come, darling, let's go out to the countryside and spend the night in the villages. We will get up early and look at the vines to see whether they started to grow, whether the blossoms are opening and the pomegranate trees are in bloom. Here I will give you my love.
That's what I'm reading for me.
What's the love? What chapter are we in?
That's
7. So anyway, so now she sees herself, so basically she sees herself as the one that Jesus, the groom, desires, Okay, so now she's motivated. This is the main theme. And now she wants to serve because she realizes this is what's important. So she's motivated by love and the fact that she's surrendered to him. I'll go up the mountain of myrrh. I'll do what you want. You're my beloved. This is your garden. You know, I'm telling everybody about you now. So she's evangelizing and she's ready to serve. So now she goes out to do it. Now she finally does something. She hasn't done anything, you know, in terms of physical work until this verse here, where she goes out now and she goes to see how things are going out in the fields. You know, they go to the villages, which are, you know, let's go forth into the fields and lodge in the villages. You know, the fields are where things are growing. She says, let's go, 4 different times. She says, let's go. And there's some references there. You know, the fields are mission fields, and those can be anywhere. The mission field now is here. And as we were talking about before, all those great churches in Europe that sent missionaries to Africa and Asia and the Americas, now they just have to send them to the corner. We have to have missions in the parishes. Because people think that, you know, showing up at Christmas and, you know, going to some minimal thing, that they're involved. And it's just, it's a total failure of understanding evangelization. And what's worse is these people think that they're in good shape. If they show up once in a while and they say a prayer and, you know, they show up at Christmas and Easter and, yeah. That's right. They're not doing anything too bad. They're nice to everybody. So they think everything is okay. And so she's so empowered now that she wants to go to these out of the way places. She wants to go see if the vines are maturing, which means fruits being born. She wants to go see maturing fruit, what people are in the faith and bearing fruit. Who isn't? Are there places that have to be cultivated and taken care of? Because the whole point, of course, is to bear fruit. You can look real nice, especially as a fig tree. You can have beautiful green leaves and look really nice from a distance. But if you don't have any figs, you're not accomplishing what the tree is meant for. Right? And it's like, I like to use the example of Judas. Because if you would have been there then, and you would have seen Jesus walking with the 12, and you would have seen Judas, he was in the inner circle. He had the treasury, you know, probably some kind of bag over him, always talking with those guys, you know, and if you'd see him, you'd say, wow, he's in Jesus' inner circle. Jesus trusts him to be the treasurer. That guy's got to really be awesome, because it looked nice from a distance. Yeah, you can see people in church who look really good. Remember, I don't know if we did First Samuel here, but Samuel goes to anoint David, and the first brother comes out who's this strong, handsome guy, and Samuel says, oh, this has got to be the guy. And God says, no, he looks good, but he's not the guy. Because I can see his heart, you can't see his heart, and I can see his heart. So, you know, it's you can look good and not bear fruit. And what's it say, you know, John the Baptist and Jesus pointed out quite a few times, if you don't bear fruit, what happens? Tree gets cut down and thrown in the fire. So she's going out now to see the fruit growing. And of course, she's concerned with this now because the fields are his inheritance. You know, the bride is his inheritance. Remember, we become co-heirs with Christ, as we learned in Romans. So like what's going on out in the fields is God's inheritance, right? The church is God's inheritance. Because after all, the people that come along and follow are going to be with them, in the end, and the people who don't aren't. They're not his inheritance. So the bride now is very interested to see what's going on in the fields. And she wants to go with him. Remember in chapter 2, he comes and says, hey, come on, you know, the turtle doves are singing and the winter's gone and let's go out. And she says, no, no, no. You want to go? Go ahead. I'm just going to hang out here for a while. You know, let me know how things go. We'll see you. But now she's going out with him because she wants to see the fruit. And it says there she's going to have intimacy with him. In other words, when you're serving, when you're doing the work, you have intimacy with him. And she's walking with him in the ministry. She's serving others while she's serving him. I mean, this is what she's been commissioned to do. And the whole point is to get his inheritance, which are more people into the church, more people as believers. And she's not doing it because he's saying, look, you didn't want to come in chapter 2. Well, he didn't say that. They didn't have chapters. She's not going because he said, hey, before you didn't want to go. Now you better go or you're going to be in trouble. She's going because now she understands. She loves him. She's surrendered. She understands the myrrh. She understands that he sees her as his beloved. So now she goes willingly. It's just like in Romans when, you know, Paul talks a lot in chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8 about how when you're following the law and you're trying to do the law rigorously, you do things because you want to follow the law. But when you do things, when you encounter Christ and you love him so much, you do things because you want to do it for him, not because you feel like, I better do this or else I'm going to be in trouble. You do it out of a transformed heart. So now she's just doing it because she wants to do it. So now she's a mature bride. She's a mature servant. See, at the beginning of the book, she wanted everything on her terms. I'll sit here. Here's my garden. Here's my stuff. This is my nice house. This is the stuff he built for me in this school. But now she understands that it's all for him. It's not for her. It's not about us. You know, Paul says, woe to me if I don't preach the gospel. I can't brag about preaching the gospel. Woe to me if I don't preach the gospel. Because that's what we have to do. So she's serving because now she has the connection. She understands. She has the love. And it's undistracted now. She doesn't care what problems are going to come. There's going to be disappointments. But she's going to do it. There's some references there at the bottom of the first page you can read later. Philippians 3:10, 1 Corinthians 15:10, and 2 Corinthians 11:23-28. So this is what it's about. What it's about, well, we're all maturing. This is what it's about, though. You know that. This is what she's doing now because she's transformed. Okay, now, I know the verses are probably messed up. I can see mine's already messed up. That verse 14. But my translation here doesn't have a 14. Yeah, read about the mandrakes.
The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and at our doors are all choice fruits. Both fresh and mellowed fruits, my lover, I have kept in store for you.
So now they're gathering up the fruit. Like, wow, look how much fruit we've produced. We're doing it. They're doing it together. The bride and the groom are doing it together. Isn't that cool? Mandrakes are these beautiful purple flowers. They have beautiful fragrances. And the ancient people thought that that would bring love and fertility. And if you remember back in the when we did the Torah class, there was a discussion between Leah and Rachel about mandrakes. But anyway, but the impact of this ministry now is bringing pleasant fruit. And you notice what's happened here? She's excited that she's bringing him the fruit. See, we have to be excited that we bring to Jesus stuff that we've done. Not because we've done it, but because he's wanted you to do it. There's no boasting. Remember how many times in Romans Paul said that there's no room for boasting. There's no boasting. You do it because you do it. You know, Jesus does in one of the Gospels about the servant. You know, when a servant comes in from the field, the master doesn't say, oh, you've been working hard. Let me make you some dinner and sit down and relax. He says, no, make me my dinner and stuff. Because a servant does what he's supposed to do. The servant is meant to serve. Not meant to be waited on. We're not meant to be sitting around someplace comfortable. We're meant to be doing work. So what she's doing here now is she's excited that she's brought the fruit to show them. Look at all this great fruit that there is now. The garden's growing. The fields are growing. The grapes are budding. The figs are growing. Pretty exciting. And, you know, we get rewards for this in the sense of, you know, we get crowns for things, but in Revelation 4:10 it says we throw our crowns at his feet. It's not about us. I'm excited about that too. I just want to be there. I don't care what level I'm at. I don't care. I don't care if they say, oh, you can't see Paul because he's, you know, 28 levels higher than you are. So that's okay. I'm just happy to be here. He's here. You see, now the harvest is coming in and she's excited about the harvest. We should be excited about the harvest. You know, it should bother us horribly that attendance at church is 30%. It should bother us horribly that people have no clue. In fact, all right, well, let's read chapter 8, and I don't know if you guys got the right verses or not. Let's read the first two verses of 8.
That you were my brother, nursed at my mother's breast. If I met you out of doors, I would kiss you, and none would taunt me. I would lead you, bring you in to the home of my mother. There you would teach me to give you spiced wine to drink and pomegranates.
See, there you go with those pomegranates. You got them. Yeah, because it's red, it means it's related to your emotions, like when your face and cheeks get red. And we were just joking because Joe's Bible doesn't have pomegranates. He had like kiwi fruit or something. No. So now this is a little bit confusing. See, the mother is always the church in this book. Okay, so the mother's the church. Remember, there's father, God is the father, the church is the mother. So, you know, you're talking about your brothers. At this time, the only men you could walk around in public with were your father, your brother, or your husband. You couldn't walk in public with any other man. I mean, you wouldn't. So, like, if Lynn said, hey, let's go over to my neighbors and bring this thing over, and her and I were walking down the street, in ancient times, everybody would go, because you only walked with your father, your brother, or your husband. That wasn't scandalous. So here she's talking about, you know, brothers. She wants to be more bold. There's a couple of references there. And, you know, she has this relationship where she wants to express more of her relationship with God in public. But that sometimes is not well received. So, you know, it makes people nervous if you go out and stand outside and talk about your love for God. And, you know, remember he said, he calls her my sister, my spouse. In Hebrews he says he's not ashamed to call us brethren, because we're his brother too. So she wants to make a more public show of her affection, but she's kind of afraid to. She wants to bring him in to where all these other people are. The church is a mixed bag of people. You know, the church is not monolithically all kind of holy, observant people that are following the Lord. There's all kind of different people in the church. Right? I think we would agree with that. I mean, there's some people don't go at all and say they belong to the church. And there's some people. So there's those members, and then there's the members that are in the front, and they're doing the Bible studies, and they're doing the prayer meetings, and they're always there for the, you know, what's going on, and they want to serve, they want to help out, they want to run the things, they want to help out with the, you know, decorate for Christmas. You know, there's all the people that are doing all the stuff. So she wants to bring the groom in so everybody can see him, because everybody there's got to see him. You know, the guy sitting next to you in church may think that the gospel means just be nice to everybody and don't kill anybody. Don't know anything about the cross. There might be a guy sitting next to you who's like my sister who just decided for some reason to come that day. So she wants to bring him in to the where the mother is so that everybody can see her beloved. Because, again, the woman at the well, Jesus talks to her. She gets excited. She runs into the town, says, come and see who I met. Could this be the Christ? They all come out. Then all the city spends 2 days there talking to them. He tells his disciples, don't do any ministry in Samaria. And he never went to Samaria any other time except that one time. So for 2 days he talks to the townspeople because she brought them there. Come and see who I found. The first chapter of John is all these guys come. We were talking about Nathaniel under the fig tree in Lillian's book. Come and see who I found. Andrew goes and gets his brother, Peter. Come and see who we found. You know, Philip goes and gets Nathaniel. We found the Messiah. Come and see him. Because when you find him, you don't say, I found Jesus. This is really nice. Now I'm happy. Just like the gifts of the Spirit that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 12 is for the building up of the church, the building up of the body. If you get a gift from the Holy Spirit, you don't just sit in your living room and like enjoy the gift and just do it for yourself and say, oh, this is great. It's for the building up of the body. So he wants everybody to see now that she has this relationship with Jesus and wants him to be honored like she honors him, wants them to see how she's been transformed by him so that everybody else can too. So she wants to take him, you know, even though the Holy Spirit, you know, empowers us for the ministry, you know, we have to, number one, be docile and go along, but we also can make some decisions ourselves as to what would be the best place to go or best way to do something. But normally he'll tell you, and you've probably had the experience where he says, that guy over there, go talk to that guy over there. So she goes back. Now remember, the church instructs us when we're little kids, right? I mean, the church instructed my sister. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to my sister. Hopefully she'll see the light and be saved, but, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. The church instructed me. I was like, yeah, whatever. My parents weren't concerned in the least whether we went to church or not. So it was just kind of like, you know, loose and kind of like a do whatever you want kind of thing. So, but we got instructed. You know, we did go to, you know, what we used to call catechism. Which you know, the church teaches us stuff, but we don't all, you know, the seed doesn't always fall on the fertile ground. You know, the parable of the sower. So now, you know, she wants to go back where she was instructed, back to the church, to say, here he is, and let me tell you my testimony. If you guys don't know him, you really should get to know him. If you guys are here just because, you know, it's Sunday morning and you're supposed to be here, let me tell you why you're supposed to be here. Here he is. And this is what we have to point to. And that's also an encouragement for, you know, you see, she's getting, there's spiced wine, there's pomegranates, there's sweet things that are coming, which also is associated with grace and the Holy Spirit giving gifts, whatever your translation says. When we were doing the Torah class in one of the places, there was this guy who had this weird translation. I mean, it was weird. It was one of these, like, new modern English, you know. It sounded like you were talking on, it sounded like it was a TV show, you know, some of the words and stuff. And then, you know, the part where Abraham cuts the animals and God passes through as a flaming torch, or they called it a barbecue pit. So they said, God passed through the halves of the animals like a barbecue pit. We're all looking at each other going, barbecue pit? Where did they get that? Anyway. You have barbecue pit in your... So anyway. So, Now let's do 3 and 4. Oh, wait, that's solid. The next two verses.
Left hand is under my head. His right hand caresses me. Young women of Jerusalem, smile. Young men of Judah, rejoice. Young men of Ephraim, swear.
Now, if you remember, there was a part in an earlier chapter. The left hand is the hand she can't see. When he's embracing her, his left hand is under her head. If you're embracing somebody like this, they can't see this hand. It's behind your head. So it's kind of like the work that God's doing that we can't see with our eyes. We can't observe it. And the fact that the left hand holds up the head, it's support, you know, protection. The other hand is visible. If somebody's holding your head in their left hand, assuming you're facing upward, the right hand is visible. So the right hand is the works that you can see. And, you know, the Spirit's been working on her in all these different seasons. And the daughters that she's talking about, again, are these immature believers who don't really understand how the Holy Spirit works. But even though they're there, the bride's not supposed to be disturbed by that. I get disturbed by that all the time. Well, like if I'm doing something and somebody says, I don't understand what you're talking about, and this just sounds weird to me, and, you know, I try to explain it a couple times, and if they still don't get it, I get frustrated. But I'm not supposed to get frustrated. You know, the bride's not supposed to be disturbed by people who don't get it. She's mature now, but she still has, you know, he's still working. Left hand, right hand. She can't see everything that he's doing. Okay, now the next verse.
Five.
Yeah.
Who is this coming up from the desert, leaning on her lover? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. It was there that your mother conceived you. It was there that your parent conceived.
Okay. Now, she's coming out of the wilderness with him. She's coming out of the barren dryness that was her past. Remember, we had a series about this where she saw the groom coming in a carriage out of the wilderness. He comes out of the wilderness in a different way. Now, she's talking about the dryness and the wilderness that was her life, but now she's coming out with him in the strength of his grace. So now, not only is she converted and following, but she's like going with him everywhere he goes. She's become like a warrior. And this is different than the last time this was described, because the last time he came out of the desert, remember it was Solomon's carriage, he came to rescue her, to take her to the wedding. And now she's leaning on his power. She's not counting on her righteousness. This is a victory of the church. The church's power is being submissive to the Lord and not counting on our own righteousness. And it goes back to, oh, you're so beautiful. It says, I'm dark like the tents of Kedar. Oh, no, you're beautiful. You don't have any spots. Oh, yeah, no, I'm pretty dark. Now she's like, wow, I'm just hanging with him now. I'm just going to go with him everywhere he goes. And under the apple tree, you know, the apples are like a sweet place where, you know, sweet things come. And there, you know, under the apple tree, I awakened you.
Wait a minute. Daughters are saying this to the bride.
Right.
So, the immature.
Yeah. This is supposed to be the groom. The groom says, I awakened you in this place of sweetness. And, you know, you were born from the church, but now I awakened you. And I think the one thing to keep in mind is, and it isn't just, you know, the parish churches we're used to. I mean, any denomination church, you find people that are doing stuff and are on fire, and you find people that are there going, you know. Reminds me of, you knew Bob Chapp. All right, next verse.
Close your heart to every love. Hold no one in your arms
as death. Passion is as strong as death itself. It burst into flame and burns like a raging fire.
Set me as a seal on your heart, as a seal on your arm. For stern as death is love. Relentless as the netherworld is devotion. Its flames are a blazing fire.
What line is it?
6, 8, 6.
Yours is pretty different. It's a seal of fire. Now, do you remember the very first line of the whole song was, she wants kisses. She wants affection. She wants to know him. She wants love. Now it ends with her being sealed. She's now sealed by him to be the servant, to be the person who's going to do the ministry. She's sealed. That's a lot different than saying, I really want to love you. I really want you to love me, and I really want to hang out with you. Now she's sealed. And the seal, of course, was a sign of the king's authority. Like when the king put a seal on something, then it was, you know, really important. And it was wax, and they'd put it on an envelope, and he'd put his ring in it. And then that letter was sealed by the king. Or they'd have documents that had the king's seal wrapped up. You know, in Revelation it says there's all these scrolls with the seal on it. Who's worthy to break the seal? And only Jesus says. Because he's the king. So, you know, she asks for love, and now she's under his authority. She's guaranteed her, you know, marriage to him, and backed by his power. And now she has the zeal. And this business about the grave is, God's love is just as strong as death is. Nothing can escape it. You know, none of us are going to escape death. Unless we're here when Jesus comes back, which is, I think, 99% certainty. But, you know, nobody's going to escape death. If Jesus doesn't come back for another 100 years, all of us are going to be dead. I don't care how many doctors you go to, how many pills you take, we're all going to be dead. But God's love is just as strong as that. He pursues us until he has us. You know, fire can't quench that. It keeps on, you know, the love, you know, he is love, you know, for, in 1 John. Because, you know, in 1 John, in John's first epistle, it says, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. You know, we talk about how we're adopted children based on what Paul says in Romans, but he said, John writes that what proves that we're children is that God's loved us before we've loved him. So, love is so powerful that you can reject it. In fact, most people do. Most people reject it. Jesus said there's very few people that find their way, because most people reject it. But when you're in, the love is overwhelming. Right? Anytime you sin, anytime you fall, anytime you go astray, you feel that. You look at it differently than before. It's very powerful. It's just as powerful as death. Nothing escapes it. And it can't be quenched. Nothing can get rid of God's love. There's nothing that can extinguish it or quench it. That's why we have this whole book, because Adam and Eve fell. He could have just damned Adam and Eve and thrown them wherever Satan was. Could have left it at that. There would never been a human race. There'd be two humans in hell along with the demons, and that would have been the end of it. But he didn't want to do that. Yes, now read 7.
Deep waters cannot quench love, nor floods sweep it away. Were one to offer all the earnings to purchase love.
So water can't quench the fire, can't quench the love. The enemy sends other kinds of water to try to quench it in your life. Oh, if God really loved you, why did you have a heart attack? Come on. If God really loved you, why are you diabetic? He doesn't love you. Look what he did. you know, if God really loved you, you'd be making a lot of money, you'd have a great retirement plan, you'd have a much nicer car. See, he doesn't love you that much. And he's okay. So relentless. Satan has to try to block that. Right? I mean, Satan has to try to block the idea that God loves you so much that he died for you and that you'll turn to follow him because of that. He has to block that. He doesn't really love you that much. Oh, sure, he loved, you know, Moses and Peter and John the Baptist and those guys. But look at you, you're a wreck. He didn't love you. Right? You ever heard that? I hear it all the time. Who do you think you are? He doesn't love you. So this is the, you know, this is a powerful example of the Spirit. You know, they're talking about fire. They're talking about being sealed. You know, we're all sealed in the Spirit as believers. As followers of Jesus, the Spirit dwells in us and we're sealed in the Spirit. Right? Holy Spirit lives in us, as we learned in Romans. Lives in us. So that is always burning. You know, Jesus said, if you come, you know, you're going to have rivers of fountains and rivers of living water inside of you. You know, this is all based on Old Testament imagery about the waters. And so it's all inside of you. And then he adds, and there's some references there, then he adds that you can't buy this with money. It doesn't have anything to do with wealth. It doesn't have anything to do with wealth. Whether you're Bill Gates or whether you're the guy who cleans his toilet, that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter where you were brought up. It doesn't matter where you live now. It doesn't matter what your position is in human society. Just because you're a king or a president or some multi-billionaire, that doesn't mean doesn't matter because it can't be bought with money. Right? You can't say, and you, even in a good way, let's face it, an atheist can be very philanthropic, right? If you were a billionaire and you were an atheist, and you said, well, I'm going to give $10 million to this charity over here, I'm going to give $10 million to this charity over here, that's nice, but that's not going to buy you salvation. You can't buy it. Nothing to do with wealth. That's in Philippians 3:8, but we kind of already know that. So now comes another weird verse. Read 8.
We have a young sister, and her breasts are still small. What will we do for her when a young man comes courting?
So now she starts to intercede for immature believers in a different way. The love's overflowing from her now, all this love she's been talking about. You know, she's talking with Jesus and saying, we. This is how close she is now. Say, we. She identifies her and him as we. And she's joined him in this partnership. And these are immature believers that now she wants to get involved in the deeper things. She doesn't want them to stick with, you know, the first grade catechism book, which most people would be happy sticking with. Right? Remember, Paul talks about, well, I gave you guys milk because you weren't ready for meat, and then I come back and you guys are still drinking milk. So what's the problem here? You know, you can't, like we said last time, you know, if you have a 1-month-old baby, you can't grill a steak and make a baked potato for him and say, here's your dinner. Right? That would be ridiculous. But on the other hand, if you have a 10-year-old that only drinks milk, that would be weird. So it's the same here. There's a maturing that goes on. You have to start on milk. So the first grade catechism book is milk. You know, understanding the basics of Christianity, the basics of the gospel, the basics of faith is the milk. Of course, what we were saying before, we can't even say, well, everybody knows that stuff, because they don't all, but, you know, now you want to go into the deeper things. You want to mature like she's matured. So now she wants these other people to mature. Because she's into the deeper things now, and she has this deep relationship. Now these sisters that aren't mature, they can't really help each other or help even less mature people like she can. Because now she's developed to the point where she can nurture. Remember, the breath is about nurturing. Now she can nurture more people. The immature people can't do that yet. But you see, the bride now is concerned about them. See, she says, what shall we do for our sister? So what I got is that the spoken for means when she stands before the Lord, which is her wedding day. So they need to mature. The bride asks him what they can do. You know, you pray for guidance when you're teaching people, when you're approaching people that, you know, may not even, like the girl I was talking about, that may not even have a clue what you're talking about. You have to ask the Lord, like, how do I approach this better? You know, you do it together. Because, of course, it's done through the Spirit. Okay, now read 9.
She is a wall who will build upon it a silver parapet. She is a door who will reinforce it with a cedar cornice.
So a wall means defense. It's something that's a demarcation. It's a border. You know, walls protect people that are inside and keep the people that are outside. Enemies out. You know, every ancient city had a wall. So the enemy couldn't just come into the city. So the battlements are on top of the wall, where you have defense, you have watchmen, you have the watchmen looking out to see who's coming. You have battlements up there with weapons. They're watchmen, they're defenders. And generally, of course, they're made of stone. But here it says the battlements are going to be made out of silver, which represents redemption that we talked about before. So the walls are a God sign of redemption for the people that are inside. It's another kind of imagery of the church, the garden inside the wall, sources of water are within it. We talked about all that. So that the enemy is not supposed to be able to just come in and trample everything. Although I think we would agree that in our culture, the ramparts are being stormed pretty fast. And the door, that opens the way to others for salvation. It opens the way for grace and salvation. So those are the evangelists, the teachers, the catechists, the priest, the minister, you know, whatever you call them. Colossians 4:3. So you open the door so that people can come in, but the wall stands as the battlement against the attacks of the enemy. And cedar, of course, is durable. We went through that. It smells good. It doesn't rot. It's expensive. And it goes along with the cedars of Lebanon being these beautiful, majestic, strong trees that don't rot. So the doors, you know, aren't supposed to rot. They're supposed to be pleasant for us as a place where people come in. You know, if you make the door something that says, if you want to join our church, here's all the rules. If that's your first approach, you're not going to get too many people coming through the door. You got to make the door fragrant and beautiful and so people want to come. And so the bride says, we do this. Meaning her and the groom. Meaning her and Jesus. So now, okay, now read verse 10.
I am a wall, my breasts are like towers, so he considers me to be one who has found peace.
So now this is her true spiritual identity. She's a wall to protect others, She's not concerned about herself anymore. She's concerned about the others. She uses her time and her strength and her resources for this. I know we're going through this kind of fast, but, you know, and of course the breasts are like towers, so she has the ability to nourish people. Not physical nourishment, obviously, but spiritual nourishment. She can teach them, she can pray with them, she can instruct them, she can, you know, kind of disciple them along. Which is the other thing, you know, that's, along with new evangelization, you also have to have a way to disciple people so that they're going to stay involved. It's urgent, urgent, urgent. Everything's coming apart. It's not going to come apart. It's going to be a remnant, but it's an urgent time of evangelization. So she has total confidence now in what she's supposed to do. Total confidence. And she knows it's not from her, it's from him. And it says, you know, she talks about peace. She found peace in him. You know, in his eyes, she's at peace. See, and I was in his eyes as one who brings peace. She's at peace no matter what's happening around her. She's at peace because she's with him. Now, what kind of horrible things are going to happen to you in your life? But if you're with him, it's different than if you're not with him. If you're just going on the waves are just going to batter you. It's much more difficult to go through hard stuff. And everybody's got to go through hard stuff. And such a stillness. It's personal things, family, you know, all the work things. So all those things, she's going to be able to stand because she's sealed now. She's not going to waste her energy on fear, anxiety, and self-condemnation because she knows that she's his partner. You know, remember Jesus said, who by worrying can add a single hour to their life? You can't add a single hour to your life. We all do worry, of course. But, you know, if you're going to die on April 14th of 2019, you're going to die that day. Doesn't matter how much you worry about it, or how you try to stop it. But, you know, if he's your partner and you're walking with him, you know, in 1 Peter 5, I don't know if I listed that there. No. But in 1 Peter 5, I think it's verse 7, it says, cast your anxieties on him. And the Greek word there for casting is the same word as when you're shoveling dirt when you're digging a hole. So it's like you need to just like shovel out all your anxieties right on top of him. Because he can handle it and you can't. He can handle it, I can't handle it, but he can handle it. So when you're in partnership with him, you throw all that dirt on him and he says, there's no problem, I can handle this. Okay, now 11.
Solomon had a vineyard at Balaam. He gave over the vineyard to caretakers. For its fruit, one would have to pay 1,000 silver pieces.
It's another kind of random thing. Remember in the song? Remember in the song, Solomon and Jesus are interchangeable in the song. Groom, Solomon's really the groom. Solomon's the one who's writing it. He's the groom. He was groomed like hundreds of times. He had so many wedding pictures that couldn't even put them up. Like, you guys have a few wedding pictures up. That's nice. You know, we have a few wedding pictures. Solomon wouldn't have been able to do that. He would have had to have buildings for it. Anyway. So, you know, Jesus has a vineyard too. And if you want to read something cool, Isaiah 5, verses 1 through 7. You know, a vineyard has everything in it that relates to how God works. You know, the ground has to be ready. It has to be watered. You have to plant. It has to be cultivated. You have to get the weeds out. You have to let the sun shine on it. You have to protect it with a wall so that animals don't come in. And so a vineyard expresses every aspect of Christianity. And, you know, this place that's littered here, mentioned here, Baal Hamon, the commentary I read said they weren't able to find an actual place that had that name at that time. So I'm not sure what that means. But he leases out the vineyard to his workers, to his keepers. And if you read that passage in Isaiah, it's about Israel. And it says, what more could I have done for you? Now remember, this is written Isaiah 700 to 750 years before Christ. And he says, you know, I planted a vineyard, I made the ground nice, I put a wall around it, I built a wine press, and it all got trampled down because you guys didn't take care of it. What else could I have done? And he's talking about how Israel's the vineyard, and they're not going to accept the Messiah, and they're going to be judged for it. You know, he leases out the vineyard. You know, Jesus has a really big vineyard. He's leasing it to the church, who is us. We're the workers in the vineyard. You know, the great parable about the workers who go in the vineyard and they all get the same pay at the end. And the guys at the beginning go, hey, wait a minute. I've been here since 7 and that dude's only been here for a half hour and how come I get the same pay he does? So, you know, it's, in the thing from Isaiah, you know, the owner traveled to a far country. You know, it's, he wants the vineyard to bear fruit. And it's up to us. We're the keepers of the vineyard. We're the workers in the vineyard. Solomon had a vineyard. He leased it. He leased it out for people to take care of it. And this 1,000 pieces of silver thing, you know, 1,000 in Judaism was a complete number. It represents full measure. In other words, the vineyard was perfect then. He wants it to be a perfect vineyard that's bearing fruit. Jews liked 1,000 and they liked 10,000. They thought 10,000 was the ultimate number. That's why it says the Messiah is the fairest of 10,000. You know, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. See, to us, you say, well, that's no big deal. There's more than 1,000 hills. But to them, that was like a number of perfection and was big, which meant he owns all the cattle. So, 12.
My vineyard is at my own disposal. 1,000 pieces are for you, O Solomon, and 200 for the caretakers of its fruit.
So the bride knows that she has her own vineyard that's her responsibility. We have a vineyard that's our responsibility. I mean, the church in the big sense, of course, is the big vineyard, but we all have vineyards that we work in our daily lives. Right? Yeah. So she knows now that these are her responsibility. Back in chapter 1, she said her vineyard wasn't kept. Remember, she said, my vineyard is not kept. My vineyard's a mess. But she wasn't doing what she's supposed to be doing. I mean, before I knew the Lord, my vineyard was a disaster. There were pigs running through it, and all the grapes were trampled down. But now she understands that this is her responsibility. Now she's confident that she's going to have 1,000 pieces of silver and able to be able to do it, the perfect number. So her vineyard's going to be good. She's going to be able to harvest fruit from it. And the keepers are going to also get the fruit. You know, everybody's going to get fruit from this vineyard because she knows now it's her responsibility and that Solomon / Jesus is going to make that possible. 13.
O garden dweller, my friends are listening for your voice. Let me hear it.
So here, O you who dwell in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Okay. She's serving in the garden. She's not hiding anymore. She's not in her place where she was comfortable. You know, you see their gardens is plural. So she's in a bigger and bigger area where she's working because of her maturity, because of how far she's come. And they see God God in her, the fellow workers see what she's doing and are inspired by what she's doing. And Jesus calls out one more time to hear her voice. He loves to hear her voice. Calls out one more time to hear her voice. This is worship and intercession. You know, while we're working, of course, we have to keep worshiping. You don't just do the work. You still have to worship. You know, if your ministry is to run an orphanage somewhere, you don't, doing the work is important, but you still have to worship and pray. So he still wants to hear your voice. See, he wanted to hear it at the beginning, and now she's walking in union with him. And so, in different ways, we let him hear our voice. Worshiping, intercession, teaching, evangelism. The enemy wants to silence our voice. Remember in Romans 10, it says people come to faith because they hear somebody preaching the word. The enemy wants to silence that. That's why you can't talk about scriptures in the society. That's why you can't talk about nativity scenes. That's why you can't talk about prayers at your graduation, because the enemy wants to silence your voice, wants to silence that evangelism, or people that are going to be there that might say, wow, what's he talking about? I never thought about that. The enemy wants to stop that from happening. So he wants to silence your voice. But Jesus said, I want to hear your voice. He's listening, you know, and if you're ashamed to tell your neighbor something, you know, he says in the Gospels, well, if you're ashamed of me, I'm going to be ashamed of you. You're ashamed of me. You know, are we going to worry more about some person thinking we're kooks and denying him and not having the guts to say to the guy, well, you know, I follow Jesus and this is what he tells me to do and what you're doing is wrong, not in a condemning way, but in a condemning way, you know, but you're doing it in a convicting way. So if you don't ever do that, then he's going to say, well, gee, I guess you were ashamed of me. So now, the last verse.
Come to me, my lover, like a gazelle, like a young stag on the mountain.
Ooh. Yeah, she wants him to come quickly. You know, he's the beloved. Her love for him is like so strong now, stronger than ever. And back to that, this is going back to chapter 2 when it says he's a stag and a gazelle leaping over the mountain. Now she wants him to do that. Before it was kind of scary, back in chapter 2. She wanted to stay in the house and she didn't want to do this leaping stuff. Now she wants to hurry up and do it. She wants to conquer the mountains. She wants to make the mountains of spice. And, you know, this is basically the new Jerusalem. She wants to turn the mountains into mountains of spice, which is going to be the end, whereas the marriage supper of the Lamb, the marriage feast of the Lamb. She wants to bring people in to the vineyard, into the wall, into the church, into the body, into the bride, so that they're going to come to the marriage supper of the Lamb. When we go into heaven, there's going to be wedding bells ringing. This is the marriage supper of the Lamb. And so she's gone a whole long way from the first chapter, first verse where she said, well, I want to kiss you and love you and I want you to love me, to now she wants to do everything for him, totally committed to ministry, totally committed to bringing people in, totally committed to getting people ready for the marriage supper of the Lamb. That's the end of the song. I know that's a lot of stuff.